very welcome to Ulster University and to the second day of the Belfast Festival of Politics and Ideas.
Hi, I'm Carmel Rolston, and my colleague Fiona Ash is suffering from laryngitis and has already managed to do a talk earlier. So I'm going to fill in the presentation part and Fiona's saving her voice for the answer to your many interesting and no doubt challenging questions. Just to repeat what Cathy has said, thank you so much for coming, and our thanks to the Belfast Festival of Ideas for hosting these events, giving us an opportunity to try out our ideas in a setting that's going to provide us, I think, with valuable commentary, new ideas and new data I'm sure that we'll incorporate. I should say that Fiona is suffering somewhat from the fact that I have never knowingly deleted a slide from a presentation. I believe there may be a television programme like those The Hoarder Next Door shows for people whose PowerPoint presentations represent an accretion of every interesting idea they've ever had over the course of their life, which obviously in my case that makes them very unwieldy and very untidy. Going to look for eye signals. She's not exactly puppet mistressing me here, but I'll take the odd look at Fiona. If she's going, I'll move on quickly. So, who cares about gender in dealing with the past? Sorry, my slide transitions are always going to be problematic in a unfamiliar computer. Right, you're not going to work me, but you may need to work the computer. There we go. That's great. So I just hit that one on familiar computers. Probably revealed even a heinous crime as being an Apple user. So why does dealing with the past matter? Well, as other scholars, our colleagues in the Transitional Justice Institute, scholars working at our fellow university, Queen's in Belfast, and various international scholars have documented, dealing with the past has become regarded as an essential part of conflict transformation, the post-conflict processes of building new institutions. With a view to preventing future conflicts, of making that shift from open armed conflict to something that resembles what we would all identify as peace a little bit more likely. There are not a lot of factors, shared narratives, for example, understanding of different narratives of conflict can consolidate peace processes. You also have a lot of considerations of justice, recognition and reparation for breaches of international humanitarian law, and a process of allowing people to express how they have suffered, how the conflict has impacted on them, which can help to build new ideas about the future. However, of course, these processes themselves are fraught with difficulty by its very nature. Processes of conflict transformation are taking place in the shadow of violent conflict, and the factors that have produced the conflict have simply not gone away. As my colleagues Chris Brown and Finola Nealoin pointed out, deeply divided societies are zones of contested narratives backed by formidable social capital. These are not just ideas in people's heads that cause them hurt. They are embedded in the structures of our societies, and people are incentivized in various ways to hold on to those ideas and those practices. So it's not an easy process. However, it's something which messy, difficult, and problematic as it is, should be undertaken. So why does gender matter? In our view, gender matters because, firstly, despite increasing international recognition of the importance of recognising gender differences, most notably in recent years, looking at the differential impact of conflict on men and women, girls and boys, and looking at the ways in which political processes have not allowed women to a proper space to articulate their perspectives and influence future decisions. For all those reasons, there has been insufficient concern with gender issues in peace processes, peace conflict transformation processes, and dealing with the past. And while you could have quite a lively discussion about the extent to which gendered power hierarchies are a cause of conflict, there is no doubt that gendered hierarchies are a factor, and a very relevant factor, in analysing societies' relationships and in trying to build future inclusive institutions. So why does gender get left out? Well, firstly, you see not only in Northern Ireland but in a great many societies attempting to emerge from conflict, ethno-national, religious, these so-called overarching communal identities tend to have priority in dispute resolution and in political processes. Gender is not perceived as being central to resolving what, in the classic world of international politics and conflict studies, strategic studies, are regarded as hard political issues. There is certainly a perception, as Christine Bell, now at the University of Edinburgh, has noted, that you can add too much into peace processes, you can add too many different factors, and there's a perception that if you start to add everything in, gender, class, all sorts of other identities, you overburden the negotiations. Certainly, my former very successful doctoral student, Sala Arousi, studying the impact of UN Security Council Resolution 1325, which in 2000 set out a framework for ensuring that women participated in peace negotiations. Her study of how that was implemented certainly indicated that nobody was going to break down a peace process because there weren't enough women. They simply, the negotiators, the mediators, people appointed by the UN themselves, didn't consider gender hierarchies to be that important. So it is very problematic. That's why gender does get sidelined. And there's also, certainly in Europe, to some extent in other parts of the world as well, a perception that gender issues, they go on in a different part of society. And you sort out gender inequalities through all sorts of different ways. So things get better in that area of life separately. It's all linked in Northern Ireland, we think, to the particular framework of power sharing and the consociational form which has been adopted. A recent article by Hayes and McAllister pointed out, and we're inclined to agree, that women in particular are frequently ill-served by such peace settlements as gender equality becomes sidelined. We could add to that that there are other identities. Men's identities can be sidelined, and that we have to find ways of making sure that these consociational power sharing frameworks don't hand all the power to elite privileged leaderships that carry on with their dispute in less openly violent ways as they share out spoils of transitions. So gender issues are taken care of separately. Have gender equality issues been resolved in Northern Ireland? Well, nobody would say that we're in the same position as we were 100 years ago. Nevertheless, when we look at who is who in the decision-making process, and this is a picture from the recent Haas O'Sullivan talks, we can see that there was a little bit of an absence of women. Nobody is saying that simply counting the women is going to make anything better, but it's a good starting point, in our opinion. And that photograph, for example, was taken after the ladies were asked to move into the foreground. So we have to watch out for the slight tendency to think that you've solved everything when you've added a couple of women into the mix. So we're building in our project on research that we've been undertaking as part of an international network of researchers who've been funded by the United States Institute for Peace. And we're building on existing research, which is attempting to focus on what happens to concerns with gendered power relations in conflict transformation processes. So, as this slide indicates, there tend to be lots of, and as I've already indicated, there's lots of myths and misinformed opinions about where do gender relations fit in into considerations of politics with a big P, as people sometimes refer to it. I tend to like, this is me, these slides get into my presentations regardless of Fidelma. I quite like the approach that's taken by a researcher from the University of Bradford who's written extensively on peace processes. She's interested in the conflict transformation approaches associated with John Burton, but she's always trying to point out the ways in which even that great scholar's research has tended to overlook the salience of gender. She says gender is a very dynamic and complex process where you've got individual gender identities, you have gender symbolism that varies from society to society. What's coded male and what's coded female is dynamic and changing, but there tends to be a broad differentiation when thinking of how it shifts. When my son was a teenager, going out shopping with him was a bit of a headache, but I once went to the DM shop and said, look, you could get those DM boots or those Caterpillar boots. And he said, don't be silly, girls wear those. So my idea of what was clothing appropriate for males and females was out of date, but what wasn't out of date was that it would be social death to be seen wearing something that girls wore, especially when your mother had been foolish enough to give you a name, which in the intervening years had become more coded as female than male. When he was born, Sam was a manly sort of name for a boy. By the time he was 15, it was no longer. So for him, the DM boots and the name of Sam, he would look too girly to be safe among his peer groups. So that's a trivial level, but we know that there are all sorts of other more serious ways in which gender symbolism impacts on what is perceived to be possible or impossible. And then you have the structures, the institutions that help to make the social capital associated with living your lives in particular ways really entrenched and difficult to beat. So gender is complex. Gender is also important. We know there are power effects, and we know that power is the currency of politics. So we need to look at how gender operates in societies in a fairly sophisticated way, and we always have to keep in mind that it's not simplistic. Women are diverse. Men, anywhere where women are disadvantaged, you'll find whole groups of men who are also disadvantaged. And these are important categories of analysis that we need to use to really understand what's going on in a given society at a given time. Otherwise, we'll miss what we could have seen, and in our view, we won't take up opportunities to transform the future in a way that is more meaningful, in a way that is more significant, and a way that offers greater opportunities for the future to change in the present. So, as we've already said, just as gender is complex, so the category of woman is very complex. It's not a closed category. Twitter is full of heated debates about who belongs, who's entitled to have the label woman pinned to them. And women are diverse and divided, and that has to be taken into account. But when we're interested in the conflict transformation process in Northern Ireland, in particular with issues of dealing with the past, we're taking as a starting point those groups of women who have committed themselves to being interested in these processes in a very serious way through their engagement with their communities, through the research that they've undertaken, through their attempts to influence policy, and through their willingness to stand up and offer their ideas to those who have access to the more influential levers of power in a continual way in our society. So we've looked first off at what's called the woman sector, which is a broad and diverse network of different kinds of organisations, non-governmental, community-based, grassroots organisations. And what we found was that women's organisations all attempted to influence the agenda of the Haas-O'Sullivan negotiations. For example, I happened to be present at a meeting of where about 200 women had turned up from most parts of Northern Ireland on a Saturday morning in the Europa Hotel to argue among themselves, to discuss, to work out what was important, what was not important, and to talk about how women could be empowered to think about these ideas, discuss them, clarify them, and so on. So what we find is an important area of expertise, because many of these groups have a history, they've been working for a long time, they've learnt and applied their learning, and they continue to attempt to draw in women in all their diversity. But that expertise doesn't quite get into the frame, although Megan O'Sullivan certainly did take opportunities to meet women's groups and to find out what their ideas were about the ongoing talks at the time. And we got a complex alternative agenda which was offered, which talked about security, women's ongoing sense of insecurity in their communities. And again, we have to understand these groups and organisations made it very clear that where women in their daily lives are feeling insecure, groups of men are also going to be feeling insecure. And so they offered a perspective that draws in gender as a lived experience for both men and women in everyday life, which is a particular expertise that, again, is not necessarily drawn upon. We should note, by the way, that quite a lot of the issues that they raised are part of the United Nations International Women, Peace and Security Agenda. But again, despite that great international body promoting policies on sexual violence against women, sexual abuse of women in conflict, the need for protection and for them to see justice done in their in relation to what they've suffered, they haven't really made it onto the agenda in Northern Ireland. And that's partly because, as the Women's Resource and Development Agency in their submission to the Haas-O'Sullivan talks, very well worth reading, very interesting, complex, sophisticated document, that gender equality, far from being mainstreamed, which we're not necessarily in favour of because that can be bureaucratic and not inclusive, but far from being mainstreamed, it's been side-streamed or sidelined in the process. So you got quite a lot of input from various groups of women putting the key ideas. Were they listening? Well, it certainly would be unfair to say that politicians in Northern Ireland and politicians who were present at the talks were unaware of gender hierarchies. That would be misleading, and it's not what we're saying. But there certainly is evidence that this is regarded as important, but not central in any way or significant enough to be clearly present in the agenda of dealing with the past processes. So we still kept the focus on ethno-national big community bargaining. And we got a sense of women being interesting only insofar as they belong to the category of victims. Now, that's not to say that it isn't important to have representation of victims, but the UN agenda has interestingly moved on in 2013 with the most recent Women, Peace, Security resolution, which tries to bridge that gap of either you're an active participant with potential agency or you're a victim who needs some kind of justice process, protection, punishment for perpetrators, etc. That victims can have agency, and insofar as women are victims, they may want to have a voice, not so that they can be consoled or comforted as victims, but so that they can influence the future, so that what they experience doesn't happen again. Can I do it for time? You should shut me up if I'm starting to. I'm going to run through the next few slides very quickly. Now, ethno-nationalism tends to shut out other identities, but one interesting phenomenon in the last year or so in Northern Ireland has been the introduction of consideration of another very important social identity, and that is class. And so you've had recent attempts to broaden the dealing with the past and other conflict transformation processes by drawing in class, particularly with reference to the category referred to as the loyalist working class. But what we find very interesting, because we look at everything through the gender lens, is that the figure of the loyalist working class representative is predominantly male. You have an old-fashioned, traditional, Victorian notion of the working class as being primarily constructed of men, in this case is men who are suffering economic and social deprivation. And so again, what do we find with the efforts to draw in the working class? The working class is figured as male. People didn't do this on purpose, I should say. Nobody sat down and said, let's keep the women out of this because they've nothing to say. They're all lucky and life is going better for women. Although I think there is a little bit of a myth in Northern Ireland that we've sorted women's equality and women are fine and we ought to move on from gender and look at other more significantly disadvantaged groups. And we forget that every group is gendered. So if you looked at the Cardiff talks that were hastily summoned, there were 34 or so participants. Three people present in the room were female. One was representing the Police Service of Northern Ireland. One was a facilitator for the conference. So women got in there to represent the loyalist working class just by the skin of their teeth, maybe because somebody thought, maybe we better have a woman. I wish I could say that academic discussions of the Protestant working class didn't reflect the reality of the high politics discussions. And it's not as if important commentators haven't noticed this, because right back at the point where that academic discussion was happening, we already had a discussion initiated about this. But part of the problem, I think, is there's a notion that, firstly, women are all right. We dealt with women. They've got their equality. Let's not worry about the rest of this. They should be happy. I also think there are issues as well about the whole issue of, well, why would we be interested in what women have to say? If it's very different from what the men would say, then maybe we might let them come in. So women can talk about intimate partner violence, or they can talk about sexual abuse, or maybe they can talk about discrimination at work. But in anything where everybody is presumed to have the same problem, then we don't particularly need to hear a woman's voice. I would say you are missing a lot of important input when you take that position. One of the people we interviewed for our project had certainly had the experience of being challenged in a number of venues when she would say, I think we ought to have an opportunity for women to speak. Yes, but they'll either just put the same community point of view as the men, and if they have anything specific to say, it's probably not relevant here. So you almost have, in certain contexts, as a woman, to justify in advance that your contribution is going to be significant. None of us can do that. None of us can justify in advance. We should be heard anyway. We have a notion that women understand about daily life, so the so-called bread and butter issues. They can talk about maybe a bit about how the welfare reform is going to impact on family life. But the big political, constitutional questions, women don't have that expertise. And one of our other interviewees took it a bit further, arguing that if women spoke, there are some people who think, some men who think, if you let women in to speak, they're going to go talk about stuff we'd rather not have anything disturbing us about in this context. They'll deal with anything before they deal with gender. Recommendations. We're working towards our project. This is why we're here. We want your ideas. There are all sorts of recommendations that can be put to national governments, to local governments, to international organisations, which would start to change this. Little interview that Fidelma and I did at the start, one of the questions was, look, if you were looking back from 100 years' time, that's not really likely, but, you know, could this event be significant? Would things have changed as a result of it? Well, probably not on that scale, but as an ongoing process of conversations about how you can make gender awareness more meaningful, institutionalise it, then we certainly hope so. We certainly want, for example, to see ways in which that expertise that women have gained from their non-governmental organisation, grassroots activism, to be brought in. When we started off in 1998, we had a civic forum that was meant to draw in civil society organisations to be a deliberative chamber which could not necessarily have a check on the assembly, but which could provide an arena where you would be less focused on ethno-national outbidding and safeguarding of ethno-national voting blocks. The civic forum has gone. I can't see it coming back anytime soon. But how do you build a real forum that would draw women and other civil society organisations into the policy process? We certainly think a gender audit of existing and prior negotiations would be useful. Our colleague, Catherine O'Rourke in the Transitional Justice Institute, has already embarked upon the beginnings of a gender audit, so perhaps I could put it very in a nice, simple way. Draw in some of the academics who've studied these processes, and they'll put you in touch with the expertise that's out there that we think is really important to all these processes. Thank you very much for listening. Sorry you had me and not a bit from Fidelma, but she'll speak up now. Thank you so much.
Guys, we've got about 20 minutes for questions. It's very informal. It's no hands up and, I'll take this one and this one. So, just feel free to engage with our two speakers and make comments or ask questions.
I really enjoyed your presentation.
Thank you.
At first, it was called an academic background. There's too much detail for me, but then I started to warm to it. Thank you.
We always have to acknowledge all our hidden antecedents, but that's partly my clutter problem.
Read some very clear points coming out for me, and the one that stands out for me, and I just hadn't got it. So I went away to England, went back, came over, went away to England, came back. And the thing that has the scales that have fallen through from my eyes in the last year is how up to their necks the mainstream parties are with the churches. I just didn't get it. And all the mainstream parties up to their necks in religion, but it's not just religion. I actually am a believer of sorts. But retrospective Old Testament misogynistic religion, that's the problem.
Well, I should have to say,
in my opinion,
I have some sympathy with you, and I think this notion of the entrenched social capital, reading Chris Brown and Fionnuala Neil-Owen's paper recently, it really did set off a light bulb, because what do we mean by social capital? How do we learn, and how are we continuously incentivized to keep doing the same things? And we have to look at the big institutions. I did, throw in a bit of a criticism of academia as well. Now, I have to say, I did a study on grassroots activism in Northern Ireland some time ago, and we looked at an interfaith group where they had foregrounded gender dynamics, and that was really, really interesting. So I think it's certain hierarchical religious organisations, and one of the interesting things I saw recently was campaigning about conscience clauses and defending Christians and so on. Lots of people coming forward and saying, I'm a Christian. This is not how I understand my faith. And I think that's a really good process as well that's going on, that people of faith are, so many years after the Reformation, starting to say, this much, that's important, but on other issues, we don't agree with this. This doesn't represent us. Yes,
it is that punitive Old Testament strain that is so viciously misogynistic, in my opinion. But I really enjoyed the way you drew that. But for me, you drew that. There's a lot of other stuff in there. It was interesting. And
thank you very much. We'll be following up. We'll be coming to interview you shortly. It's fatal to talk to us at all.
I'd like to share with you just very quickly a tweet that has come in about your session from someone who says, I remember being invited to knit dolls and make tea at an EPP meeting only a dozen years ago. It seemed expected.
Do you know, I think what people do is, to some extent, we understand gender is lived. We live it the best way we can as we understand it, and we're going to live out, we're going to feel real as human beings when we conform to some extent to prevailing gender norms in our society. I mean, I couldn't knit dolls, but I wouldn't turn out in public without having my hair dyed in the grey, covered up. So there's a gender age social norm that I feel better when I conform to it than if I was like some of my friends and just defied it completely. But it's the sidelining, the continual sidelining of women's concerns as being, well, interesting, maybe we can deal with that, maybe we can deal with it later, maybe it belongs here. And that expectation that if you are concerned about gender, then you're a very risky individual to have in mainstream politics. This isn't unique to gendered hierarchies. and it doesn't only affect women. If you go back 100 years, people who were part of the movement for Irish independence but who thought that class issues were important got similarly sidelined. Labour must wait. We have women must wait. And women have to do what they can in the circumstances in which they find themselves to get the most advantage and the most presence that's possible for them. If somebody asked me to knit dolls, I would happily learn, as long as it didn't mean I couldn't be on the party executive committee at some time in the future. And
how do you get around the, it seems like, you know, it's a chicken and egg. Power is in the hands of people who, in our democracy, we agree that democracy is people represented by those they elect, and constantly the refrain is, I have a right to say this because I have a mandate, I have been elected. If we aren't standing for election and being elected, can we have our cake and eat it? I understand there's a lot of power outside the elected representative process, but what we always seem to come up against, and particularly, I don't know your name, but what you were saying, you know, it's coming to the fore with a lot of social issues or issues of conscience, issues of rights that are we're being forced in Northern Ireland to sort of move into the 20th century a little bit about things to do with reproductive rights. But how do we get around that other than having, I mean, would you agree, for example, with women, you know, with positive discrimination when it comes to parties putting up women?
It's a very interesting question, and I'd love to say if they'd asked me, I wouldn't have had the single transferable multi-member constituency electoral system, because that's no more proportional. It's a bit more proportional. There's more skilled political science people in there. It's a bit more proportional than first past the post, but it has this. But it's not much more, and it has the big disadvantage of giving a lot of voter power over which candidates get to trump which. So it incentivizes clinging on to that ethno-national social capital. The Women's Coalition in the peace process did advocate for the system that you've got in Scotland and Wales, which is that additional member system where you have constituencies, but you also then have these top-up lists, which is better at achieving greater gender parity in elected assemblies. All you can do is keep trying to feed ideas like that into the mix, but you would have to get the agreement of the dominant political parties who really benefit from the system. The SDLP, Sidney Elliott at Queen's, did the maths some years ago and tried to persuade the SDLP that this multi-member constituency, single transferable vote, doesn't work very well for them electorally, but the big parties seem very wedded to it in Northern Ireland, so it's going to be a battle. Quotas is an interesting issue. I'm very old-fashioned and still think that when you try to tell people who they should vote for, you are maybe stepping over a line, because however faulty it is, democratic elections are about the citizens having the opportunity to choose their candidates. But I think that parties should be obligated, at the very minimum, it would be a start if the parties that don't put up a substantial number of female candidates in winnable seats had to be called to account for that. And for example, you know, some of the parties are better than others, but it would be good to have some sort of audit as to, well, how come your list of candidates is so drawn from such a narrow social group. But I certainly think that one thing that could be done is to look at where else do you get influence in Northern Ireland politics through public appointments. Public appointments, there are now fewer women, or a smaller percentage of women than there were in 1996. I said that with great confidence because the Commissioner for Public Appointments said it in a room where I was at, and I went and looked it up afterwards. So that's not improving. There is a big audit going on patterns of discrimination in public life that incorporates gender discrimination, age, able-bodiedness, for example, ethnic minority representation. So the process of appointments to public bodies are very fraught because there's a strict adherence to the letter of equal opportunities legislation that then mean that once you've set up your image of what a relevant person for this is, then you can't depart from that. But they're having a look at their criteria and trying to see how they can shift them in ways that are more inclusive. Big problem is this perception of who's got expertise. And Fidelma has lots of ideas about merit. The notion that people should only get into these positions of influence on merit, if they demonstrably have the capacity. Well, I put it to you, I was inspired to do a better presentation by hearing my students debating in a debate with Queen students a couple of weeks ago. My students worked so hard and their presentations were so professional that it made me want to do better. But I put it to you, the audience, are the politicians that are running our institutions showing signs of having got there on merit, or are they looking like people who got in on other criteria that maybe we wouldn't have drafted if we had been starting afresh? That's me putting words in Fidelma's mouth. She's been blighted. But I'll let you speak for yourself.
Well, the Assembly's dealing with the issue of women's representation, and that maps directly onto our research, because one of the issues that was raised over and over again was women's participation and women's protection. So the Assembly has engaged in a very broad review of why we have the over-representation of men in political life. And it's a multifaceted problem. So the one of the issues is that hanging it on this merit principle is a reason not to move what I think needs to be aggressively forward on the issue of women's participation. Really doesn't enable people to see the whole array of barriers that are there. They are multiple barriers, so then you need multiple solutions to all of those barriers.
Yes, I think that's right. It's messy, and you have to try lots of different things.
I'm just wondering, I don't know if this is in the scope of your research at all, but in looking at the way that male and female were coded as a result of the conflict, have you looked at all about how that has impacted the positionality of LGBT people in Northern Ireland?
Well, I haven't worked directly on these issues, but I'm certainly on the conference circuit, and I read the articles that have come out on that. And it really goes back to some degree to this lady's issue as well. And it's about the role of traditional ideas about gender and sexuality. I think one of the issues that this piece of research raised for us, or I don't want to put words into your mouth, raised for us was, is this process of conflict transformation challenging traditional ideas about sexuality and gender, or is this process reproducing them? Or, you know, is the process reproducing the silences of the past, the marginalisations of the past? And if so, what should the recommendations be to move this process forward and to have a piece that imagines a plural, diverse and participatory society where lots of different groups of people and individuals can share in how they want to imagine the piece? Because at the moment that the piece is being envisaged in particular ways, and I'm not sure the way that it is enabling that kind of plural vision to emerge. So I don't know what that answers.
We can even see a gender dimension to lesbian, gay, transsexual identities. It's almost as if lesbians don't exist, because we, for some reason, we don't feel we have to worry about them. If they cause us trouble, then that'll be fine. But there is this very regressive and disturbing association of male gay identities to some sort of threatening expression of sexual identity that is hostile and aggressive and goes to the concerns that many people have, is that just because there's not open warfare on the streets, we don't have a peaceful society. We have a society where power as domination is used in all sorts of contexts. And it seems to me that that particularly impacts upon people in those communities, as you've identified. That's why we say gender cuts across into all sorts of areas. And it's not just, obviously we think it's important that women's voices are heard, but it isn't ever just about the exclusion of women. It's the exclusion of a lot of women and a lot of men as well.
Women's participation brings in a lot of other groups, because as Norman says, there are cross-cutting identities.
Yes, I'd like to make two points, or different points. One is the discussion you're having, I don't think you really can have it without considering the role of the media, who both reflect society and amplify whatever's going on. For example, they frame understanding and cater to the understanding of orange and green. So if you're like me, a woman that identifies with the Alliance Party, the integrated spirits across the community, you know. When they look for women and things about women as a category, they leave, you know, it's not just gay women, etc., that are left out. It's people that just identify in ways other than what's considered the norm. The second point is, I was interested, can't remember, I think you did, you mentioned maybe Maria Cahill. No, I can't remember who you mentioned, but I was thinking about women who've been bereaved in the Troubles, and this is about dealing with the past. And I think it's very interesting that when, up until about the mid-90s, you didn't really, there wasn't a policy on, the government didn't have a policy on dealing with victims of the victims and survivors of the Troubles, didn't have a policy, it was all invisible. And when voices have been coming out in the last few years, you have Anne Travers, you have the McCartney sisters, you have Maria Campbell. And isn't it interesting that they're speaking truth to power, women? In other words, they have suffered, they have a certain moral platform, a certain strength from that. I think that's what you mentioned earlier on, something about their capital. There's a certain, it's a rough way to put it, but if something often happens to you, like, what else have you to lose? And I think this is related to the fact that it's women found their voice. I think it's related to that feeling that if you're a woman, as well as them feeling the freedom by their position, that if you're a woman, it's safer. During the Troubles, was that sort of thing, if you're a woman, it's a bit safer in Northern Ireland? I'm not sure if that's enough or not.
Well, there's...
But isn't it interesting,
in certain parts of life,
there aren't really men speaking out in this kind of way. So there's like a positive thing. It's as if they're creating a role, but again, they're almost being stereotyped, you know?
I think it's a very interesting point that you make, and it's certainly true that there's a default of going to big confrontations and disputes or big events of reconciliation around the major inclusive community identities that predominate in our politics. One of the interesting issues is to do with sexual violence against women. Women's groups have been campaigning, documenting, writing, advocating on those issues. When Maria Cahill's story broke, that was picked up as a sensational story in most media outlets because it could be linked in to the predominant narratives about who's up and who's down in ethno-national competition and bargaining. And it became then co-opted into this party attacking that party. rather than being understood as a very eloquent expression of, and a very courageous expression of a horrendous experience by someone who had suffered not only through the experience itself, but who had been further victimised by attempts to cover it up. And when that excitement fades, then the constant battle to get these issues taken seriously disappears, and the campaigning groups have to go back to the day-to-day work of trying to make small steps forward. Do we get the media we deserve? You know, media organisations are private companies that are obligated to make money and attract viewers and listeners to and readers to survive. So it's certainly true to say that we ought to challenge the dominant narratives, but we have to look as well at what are most people interested in. We've got to work on a number of different fronts to do what I suppose we're trying to do, disrupt those standard narratives and to disrupt those stereotypes. As you say, you get all these stereotypes, you get noble suffering by women memorialised in conflict, memorialisation and legacies of conflict, but that's a minority and they're exceptional women, and the rest of us, well, what did? We lived our lives, and we were, you know, we were safer during the conflict. In one level, it's probably true to say that there were times when you could experience greater security as a woman, but the whole lived experience wasn't safer, and women aren't safer if their children are at risk, and that's just too busy a narrative to be taken on board until we disrupt it.
Speaking of exceptional women, I'm afraid we're going to have to draw to a close, but I'm sure you'd like to join me in thanking our speakers for an excellent presentation.
Thank you so much.
With a few more events generally on this theme, the rest of the festival. My name is Peter O'Neill, I'm the festival director. Thanks for coming along today. With a few evaluation forms if you want to complete those.
Please do.
And say please stay on and enjoy for a conversation with our presenters. Say thanks again.
Thanks, Peter. Very much.